Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I opened with the Rio Grande singers giving us the Turquoise Dancer. Well, last week at the end of my show, you know, I talked about how a lot of us were just, you know, really disappointed in Michael Franti, you know, the word coming out of what a sexual predator he was. And that later in that day, the San Francisco Chronicle did a story on it. And, you know, the other women's names came up, one of them even as a writer, and in her Substack told the story, you know, especially the first time, you know, he invited her to come to the bus. The first thing he did was strip naked. And I'm going, Michael Franti, oh my gosh, you know, you would just never think. And I knew that there was more to the story because, as I said, you know, his management dropped him. As soon as word got out, his management dropped him. And, you know, he's a cash cow. And, they, you know, one incident you can get away with. And I said, there's just probably so much more to this story that they know about. And they're just, you know, we're waiting till the stories came out. And then they drop him. And that's what happened. But it rides on the heels of another performer who's performed here, performed at Summer Arts several times, performed in the hall, performed at Reggae on the River. And that's Naco and his Medicine for the People. And it was pretty brutal, the words that came out about his sexual prowess on young girls. And he never got charged, but two of the young girls, you know, finally told their mother what was going on, and the mothers put it all out there. I had the experience backstage at Benbow, at Summer Arts, when he was going to play, and he had played at the hall. And, you know, I'm not the kind of person that goes into dressing rooms and schmooze. That's just not who I am. And anybody that works hospitality, whatever, say, they never see me back there. But I had taken a picture of Naco.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Was Pipestone moving on? Yes, it's time to move on and let the next generation take over. It's about time. Well, when Trump did all his tariffs, you know, against Canada. Well, but you didn't have to worry if you spent up, you know, less than $800, there was no penalty or anything. But he changed that last week. So August 30th, you buy anything from Canada, doesn't matter if it's a penny, there'll be tariffs, and there's no guarantee a package will be sent in the mail to you, or it'll be sent out of Canada. No guarantee that the United States will accept the package. And it just, you know, it broke me because Jamie Gentry, who's a Native American moccasin maker and bead artist in British Columbia, she made me a pair, custom-made, my purple moccasins. If you ever see me wear them, she made them. And she's just incredible work. She's been shown in her bead work, and moccasins have been showed in museums. You know, she makes special moccasins for weddings. I mean, it's just incredible the work she did. But the majority of it comes from the United States, all her work, her orders. And she announced a couple of days ago that she was going to close shop because of this tariff thing that's happening, and she won't be able to, there's no guarantee that any moccasins she make will make it to its final destination in the United States. And there's a native clothing business out of Winnipeg that I've ordered from, because I really support the native companies, and I try to walk my talk. So now that, and they had, you know, when the first tariff thing happened, you know, months ago, they had sent out, don't worry, you know, anything under $800 is fine. And even if you're waiting for something now, if it comes in after the 30th, no guarantee you're going to get it. But there's a lot of incredible native designers here in the United States, and it's becoming bigger and bigger. Laura Goodman, Jay Okuma. Boy, she's an incredible bead worker and designer. She just had an incredible show at the Santa Fe Indian Market. There was just, you know, runway and all these different designers. Superman Hip Hop, his wife, has a clothing business, the clothes she designs. And a lot of time the runway, you know, who walks them? Women, you know, Native men and women of all ages and all sizes. Even Deb Hodlin walked down the runway in Santa Fe. And it just really excites me because, you know, in the 70s or so, I used to make clothes for people. I designed clothes. I had a friend that was living in Germany, and she'd say, could you do this with a denim? Could you do that? And I'd make it. And I still, you know, I have really, you know, arthritis in my hands now, so it's hard for me to do any kind of sewing. But I still would have fun. And I remember about 12 years ago or so, maybe 15, you know, for Reggae on the River, I said, oh yeah, I know it would be cool. And I took a old pair of jeans and ripped open the legs and, you know, put cloth in between so it became a skirt, you know, red, yellow, green. In fact, I dug it out, and I said, oh my God, my body can still fit in this. And I wore it, I think, Sunday at Reggae on the River this year. So, I mean, it's fun designing clothes, and the native stuff are incredible. In British Columbia, they have a fashion show. They've had it, I think, two or three times. And just the wildest looking native stuff. I was just like, I get excited by all the creativity. So I thought this, you know, I want to share this with you. It's from Julia Francella, and I just really appreciate all the writing that she does. And this one's called Stitching Our Future, Indigenous New York Fashion Week and the Return of Relational Design. And she says how Indigenous designers are reclaiming space, style, and story in New York City. She says there's a quiet revolution taking place in New York City's East Village. Tucked between the bodegas, tattoo shops, and late-night falafel spots, you'll find Relative Arts NYC, a brick-and-mortar community space dedicated to Indigenous design, creativity, and collaboration. I'm honored to be a resident artist there. And this September 11th through the 15th, the first ever Indigenous New York Fashion Week will take place on Lenape homelands. We gather in Lenape Hoking, the ancestral and unceded homeland of the Lenape people. This territory, which includes what we now call New York City and stretches across parts of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, has been a center of Indigenous land, trade, and diplomacy for thousands of years. And I just want to interject here, because I know I've told this story, but I'm going to tell it again. You know why it's called Wall Street? Why it's called Wall Street in New York? Because when the Dutch were able to get that Manhattan, that area there, with some, you know, the way they were able to get land, well, they wanted to make sure that the native people didn't go back to that land. So they put a wall up, and that became Wall Street. Yes, Wall Street was a wall built to keep the native people out. But to continue, the name itself, Lenape Hocking, means land of the Lenape. Though the Lenape were violently displaced by colonization, their presence here is enduring, both in spirit and resurgence. Honoring Lenape Hocking means recognizing that indigenous fashion, art, and activism in New York City are not new. They're a continuation of life waves rooted deeply in this land. Events like Indigenous New York Fashion Week don't just celebrate style. They return presence, visibility, and relationship to a place that has long tried to forget. Hosted by Relative Arts and organized by founders Karina Emmerich of the Powell Nation and Liana Skuway of Muskogee, the INYFW will bring together designers from across Turtle Island, Central and South America, and beyond. The event includes runway showcases, jewelry presentations, panels, pop-ups, concerts, and community gatherings, all rooted in Indigenous expression, story, and futurism. But this isn't just about clothes. This is about reclaiming space and rethreading the stories colonialism tried to unravel. Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island have long used dress and adornment, not only for function, but as a form of story keeping. Pre-contact indigenous textiles and garments varied across nations. The intricate finger-woven sashes of the Anishinaabe, the alpaca and vicuna fibers of the Andes, quill work and beadwork traditions, and bark cloths and feather work from the Pacific Northwest and Hawaii. These were not merely fashion statements. They carried clan, role, spirit, and cosmology. They told you who someone was, where they came from, and what they carried. And then came contact. European colonizers brought with them a different idea of clothing, one tied to capitalism, modesty laws, gender binaries, and mass production. Native styles were quickly labeled as, quote, primitive, costume, or banned altogether. Boarding schools stripped children of their traditional clothing. Potlatches and dances where regalia would be worn were criminalized. The very act of dressing indigenous became dangerous. Yet despite it all, indigenous fashion never disappeared. It adapted. It survived. And now it's thriving. And what is indigenous futurism? Well, indigenous futurism isn't a trend. It's a creative, cultural, and intellectual movement that pushes back against erasure by imagining indigenous people not just as survivors of the past, but as active participants in shaping the future. Coined by the Anishinaabe scholar Grace L. Dillon, the term draws inspiration from Afrofuturism, but carries its own unique cosmologies, languages, and land-based frameworks. Indigenous futurism emerges through fashion, visual arts, literature, film, architecture, digital art, and even science fiction, often blending ancestral knowledge with innovation. It offers visions where we are not relics or side characters, but protagonists of our stories. This isn't about reimagining ourselves into someone else's future. It's about returning to what has always been. Kinship systems, sustainability, relational governance, ceremony, and creativity all carried forward into new generations in fashion. Indigenous futurism might look like a garment that incorporates ancient beadwork alongside recycled materials and digital printing. In city planning, it's indigenous-led green infrastructure that honors land treaties and ecological wisdom. At its core, indigenous futurism disrupts colonial timelines. It says, we were here, we are here, we will be here, and we will continue to create on our own terms. Indigenous futurism isn't just science fiction. It's the act of imagining indigenous people surviving and thriving into the future on our own terms. Fashion plays a role in that. As Emmerich puts it, quote, indigenous designers are innately more sustainable because we were raised to have a stronger connection to the earth and what it provides. Most of my items are made from upcycled, recycled, and all-natural materials, and I am always trying to find ways to reinvent scrap material. We inherently created the idea of no waste in common traditional practices like hunting and fishing. Karina Emmerich also said, this ethic of relational design is rooted in ancestral knowledge systems. Clothing becomes more than something to wear. It becomes a responsibility, an offering, a reflection of land-based values where nothing is wasted and everything has meaning. To see a native design jacket, gown, or earrings on the runway is not just an aesthetic experience. It's political, spiritual, and profoundly personal. Each stitch resists erasure. Each show defies invisibility. Each piece speaks back to centuries of surveillance and control, saying, we are still here, and we're styling our own future. And I just want to interject here because I have this beautiful collection of earrings, and I probably have five or six pairs from a woman named Jessica. She's Yurok, and she just does the most incredible beadwork, necklaces, earrings, and she just sells it. You know, I mean, she could have a website and do big things, but she chooses just to sell at the Indian markets, you know, at the Indian event. She was at the Salmon Fest, Indian Days in Sacramento. And I personally, you know, I always feel so proud when I wear her jewelry. And as I said earlier, you know, I really make a point of purchasing most of my clothing from native designers. I go down to the Indigenous Red Market in Oakland when it happens, because there's a lot of times there's different people there, you know, with native clothing. So if you see some of those earrings, I know I wore one time and someone took a picture, and I'm not on Facebook, but someone told me, yeah, a lot of people are commenting about those earrings, and they're all abalone shell. And I don't know, they hang about 7 inches down. There's so much beautiful work out there, and it is a statement to wear them. It's a reminder, yes, we are still here. To continue, what makes the INYFW particularly exciting is how it blurs the line between high fashion and grassroots community. The event isn't just for the elite or the industry insiders. It's for us, for our aunties, our cousins, our youth. There will be panels, pop-ups, and concerts, each centering Indigenous.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, KMUD.org.